Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, Lockdown 3, the worst sequel ever. The situation in hospitals, homes, and for businesses is grim. So why are UK shares rising? Meanwhile, Bitcoin's gone bananas. We've also Brexited since we were all last together, but how's it impacting on our finances? Now, despite lockdown, the housing market is staying open again. We've some tips if you are planning to sell. Plus, as we are all stuck at home, we've solved some of the most common internet problems for you. Well, we didn't, but experts that This Is Money spoke to have, and we'll tell you what they said. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, here we go again. Amid rising cases in hospitals, the Prime Minister imposed a third lockdown in England with similar restrictions in place across the UK. While the vaccine rollout continues apace, we can expect to be confined to our homes until at least mid-February. Businesses got more grants, but so far, that's it for financial support measures, although we have been reading that perhaps some of those who missed out before may get some money. May. We don't need to go into the whys and wherefores of all of this, but what I do want to focus on, because I'm sure we will come back to that at some stage, many stages in the future, and what I do want to focus on, as what you focused on in your column, Simon, this week, is what's going on with UK shares. The bounce. Simon, what is going on?
Well, what's going on is your classic counterintuitive stock market movement. In a week that I think is the most depressing since, maybe the 1-2 weeks ago, we have started 2021 with another kick in the teeth. The nation has backed itself into a corner where the cases are rising, the hospitalizations are going up by so much that we need another lockdown. And the government has done what it promised it wouldn't do and closed the schools. So we're in a pickle again. And people are pretty miserable about it. It's grey, murky, first week of January, pretty cold out there. But yeah, it's not a great way to start the year. So what happens? Stock market goes up, of course, because, hey, why not? If you're sat at home, buy some shares. The reason is because basically investors are not looking at what is going to happen between now and the end of this lockdown, which hopefully is going to finish in late February, although that's a very glass half full optimistic view. But they're looking at what's going to happen after the UK, the US, Europe get over their second wave coronavirus struggles. And they are looking at the fact that once we start getting enough people vaccinated, economies are then going to start to reopen. And the cycle of lockdown, easing that we have been stuck in will hopefully be broken and we can get forward to the reopening optimism. We saw that in November with the so-called vaccine rally when vaccines came out and you saw lots of companies that have been absolutely hammered by lockdown suddenly jump. Travel firms, banks, airlines, oil companies, the big oil companies, because the demand for oil was expected to go up. Cineworld. Some of that looks a little bit premature now, I must admit. Certainly, the astonishing rise in Cineworld shares over a week in November. But what people are betting on is that companies that have got enough money and enough resources and don't have to dilute their shareholder base by so much or go bust and can survive through the lockdown will start to do much, much better in the second half of this year. Whether that comes in the second quarter, which is in normal person speak, between from March onwards, or whether it comes in the third quarter, which is from June onwards. They don't know, but they're betting on a rebound. And once the economy does properly reopen and we don't have the, we have enough people vaccinated, there's not the threat of going into lockdown, as long as things don't fall off their perch again, then I think you will see a very, very strong rebound. Consumer spending appetite is there. Some people have saved a considerable amount of money. Others haven't. Others have had no help whatsoever. But so investors are looking through that. But then we've got another thing going on here, which is Brexit. So we now have a deal. We have actually left the EU with a deal. That has lifted the air of uncertainty over the UK that has meant that big institutional international investors fund managers, pension funds, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, have had a very good reason not to buy into the UK, because they've looked at it and gone, that is an absolute clown show going on over there. They're probably going to leave with a deal, but who knows what that deal will look like. They're making noises like they might not leave with a deal, and they've done a lot of crazy stuff over the last few years. So maybe I'll just invest in that other country instead, because that other country offers similar opportunities, but with less of an air of madness around it at the moment. The Brexit deal has added an element of certainty. We're not certain what it actually means yet, but it has added that element of certainty. And so now you've got people buying back into the UK going, well, actually, UK shares look reasonably cheap. They're at a discount to global shares. It's not a bad way to play the coronavirus recovery and reopening. We've got a lot of those companies that could benefit from it. Banks, oil, big consumer brands, airlines, and so on. The pound is still trading at a relatively low level. You've got international companies coming in and going, I quite fancy buying up that little slice of Britain, because I reckon I can probably get that now about 20% cheaper than I'll be able to get it at some point in the future, because the pound's going to go back up again a little bit. So you've got all of those things being factored in. Now, what investors need to remember is that that little burst of optimism that we're seeing at the moment, it could be derailed. And actually, the UK may not be quite as cheap as it looks. It's cheap, but not quite as cheap as it looks.
We've had a few of those false dawns, haven't we? Lee, the government are betting the house, the kitchen sink, their underpants on this vaccine, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, the rollout has started to ramp up now, hasn't it? And they're hoping that by February, it's going to look like a much brighter picture than what it's looking like at the moment. But you were right there, Georgie, when you said lockdown three, the sort of, you know, the secret that no one wanted. I mean, this time around, it's felt a lot different than last time. You know, this time around, it feels bleak. Being trapped more indoors with the cold weather, with young children, perhaps. If that's you and you're listening, I think you know exactly what I'm talking about. But the bet has been on this vaccine, Georgie. And you've got to tip your hat a little bit to the government at how quickly that they're rolling this out, I would say, compared to other countries. There's been a lot of scrutiny around the government, of course, in the handling of the pandemic. It's been a difficult one to really sort of call. But, you know, I'm hoping that things are looking better now with this vaccine. It's a big bet, Georgie, but let's hope by this time next month or by the middle of next month, we'll have a bit of a clearer picture of how many people have been vaccinated, whether targets have been met. Let's just hope that people get out there and get vaccinated and we can start moving forward and the economy can start chugging along nicely and brighter times ahead, I guess.
I'm glad you said that. I mean, well done, I suppose, to the government, also particularly well done to the NHS for rolling out that vaccine quickly. Like you said, I think there's more people vaccinated in this country than across Europe entire, which is pretty good. The government haven't got everything right, but I think the emphasis on this is. Simon, I do want to ask, speculation that Rishi Sunak, because you were mentioning there about the people who've lost out, the newly self-employed, those who pay themselves in dividends, company directors, etc., anyone earning over 50,000, self-employed. There is speculation that there will be some scheme to help those who do pay themselves in dividends, who earning under 50,000. It's this 50,000 thing again. But how likely is it when it's been months, almost a year without any help? Time and time again, the calls have been made on the chance that to do something to help these people. Are we likely to get anything now?
I don't know, to be honest. I mean, we've talked about this before on the podcast, and it's absolutely mystifying to me at a point when you're dishing out help to all and sundry. Everybody said when the furlough scheme was extended until the end of March, that looks a bit suspicious. And this was a couple of months back, and lo and behold, it's come to pass. And I believe it's now been extended until the end of April. So it looks a bit strange when basically people on furlough are picking up $2,500 a month and you've got people who are self-employed getting nothing and they don't have the same fallback as others. And certainly, you know, now with the schools being shut as well, this is even more of a burden on people because ultimately employees are being paid every single month, right, by their employer. Now your employer may be more or less understanding about you having your children at home and expected to homeschool them. Your children may be younger or older and more able to be homeschooled. Primary school children, you cannot leave them alone to do homeschooling. They need to be monitored constantly. It is a full-time role looking after primary school children, especially younger primary school children. Now, those people who are employed, obviously, are still being paid by their employer, okay? And their employer may be very, very demanding, and they may be really, really struggling and having to work at nighttime in order to make up and stuff like that. Or their employer may be quite understanding, or it may be very understanding. There's a real spread of this stuff. The self-employed, those people who are self-employed and are having to do this, they don't get paid because they only get paid if they do work. And a lot of them have got no help at all. Now, there's the dividend thing. The problem is people who work in as limited company directors, many of them pay themselves in dividends in order to minimize the tax that they pay. That is the cold, hard reality of it. Now, a lot of people work as individuals, self-employed, as limited company directors, because that's how the people that they are supplying expect them to work and expect them to bill. And it's a legitimate way of working. It's a legitimate tax treatment, and they might pay lots of other tax in other ways.
It's a good way to level out times when you're going to earn more. Your times you're going to earn less is to pay yourself in dividends rather than AYE, because you don't know how much you're necessarily going to earn from month to month. So there are many reasons
And that's very true. But, you know, for a lot of people, it has been a way of minimizing their tax bills. But there hasn't been moral judgment in this coronavirus help, not in the furlough scheme. There was no moral judgment passed on the companies. Lots of big businesses got help. Now, some of those big businesses have given some of the help back. It was just that this is an emergency and we need to help out and we're not going to pass moral judgment. Whereas with the self-employed thing and the dividends thing, it seemed to be passing a moral judgment. You've got the newly self-employed, you've got freelancers who've lost a lot of their income, and then you've got this weird people who've earned over 50,000 thing going on. Now, those people are not paying themselves in dividends. They are sole traders and they have paid tax and national insurance on every single penny of their profits. And because they've earned more than 50,000 in previous years, they've actually paid lots of tax. Yet, for some reason, they've been completely excluded in a way that employees are not excluded by the furlough scheme. You can furlough an employee who's on 50 grand. The maximum they'll get every year, the maximum they'll get it based on is 30, but you can still furlough someone on 50, you can furlough someone on 75, you can furlough someone on 100. But those people who've earned more than 50 in previous years, now some of them would be doing all right. Some of them might have even earned more money this year, but then they don't need the help and they won't be asking for the help. Some of them have seen their incomes crash by 80, 90%. And the government has just said, no, we're not helping you. Rishi said, no, sorry guys, we're helping everyone else, but we're not helping you. You're completely excluded. And I mean, it's a real kick in the teeth for those people, because basically it's actually based on the fact that they've been paying more tax in the past rather than less. So I don't understand why they haven't helped these people. I don't understand why they don't pull their finger out and do something about it. We thought it's too far down the line now. They're not going to do anything. Maybe this fresh lockdown that really is a full-on lockdown that's going to last some time will change that. I don't know. What I do know, though, is, as I said before, those people who can get their businesses through this are going to be in a very strong position come the rebound that we see at the other end. So if you are one of those people who has been affected and is self-employed and is feeling like you've been kicked in the teeth, I really feel for you, but there are better times around the corner.
Excellent. That's exactly what I like to hear from you, Simon. Positivity at the end there. Lee, before we, because we started by talking about investing, and I will go back there because I want to talk about Bitcoin continuing to go mad. But before we go there, Lee, I do want to talk about travel, actually. But we've now heard that all international passengers will soon have to have a negative test for COVID before they come to the UK. That includes UK nationals. You could face a fine of £500, may not be able to fly. I pass no judgment on this decision. That may well be a great thing to do. It may not be, but it does seem a little after the Lord Mayor's show, as every other country has imposed something like this again. What will that do to the travel industry? Because we've got no termination point of this scheme, and I guess it's very hard to do that when the virus is so, well, it's up in the air, isn't it? We don't really know, but it will make it very difficult for people wanting to book to go away when, you know, it might be very difficult to try and organize how to get a test in a foreign country.
It's definitely feels like after the horse has bolted, doesn't it, Georgia? I mean, it's kind of a system that a lot of other countries have had in place. And obviously, London, especially Heathrow, being such a global airport, such an international airport, so much travel goes in and out of there. It is a surprise that it's taken this long for it to happen. There's going to be a lot of panicking influencers, I'd imagine, in some of those countries that I keep seeing people in Dubai and South Africa and those types of places are now going to have to... quickly get their act together and get a negative test in order to get home. But it does show you that, you know, there's going to be changes to travel. We don't know how much longer for, but it is one of those things that you can't, it's hard to factor in if you are tempted to get away, because things can happen and move and change so quickly. I'd like to think that most countries you'll be able to get a test pretty easily and you'll be able to get home. But I would predict next week we're going to see some horror stories of people not being able to do that. Look, I think it's the way forward. It should have been done before. And as I say, I don't know why it wasn't done before. George, I mean, thinking about going on holiday just feels like a distant dream, doesn't it? Getting on a plane, going away.
Health passports, do you reckon, like Tony Blair suggested?
Oh, I don't know about that. I think that might be going a bit too far down the road. I think I had a friend, for example, that flew in from the States and has flown back to the States. And it's so much stricter. This was a few months ago. I had to have a negative test to get into the airport, to get on the plane. You know, as soon as they got into London, got into Heathrow, it was kind of real limited. You know, you had to give them an address of where they were going, but you just know that was never going to get followed up and nothing was going to happen to prove that they'd isolated. How many people are traveling in and out of this country at the moment? I would have thought it's such a minimal impact now that it's hardly even registered on my radar, Georgie. That's how far I've gone from thinking, God, I'd like to have a couple of holidays a year to, I don't know when the next time is I'm going to get on the plane and get out of the country.
It's crazy. I was reading a thread about a journalist who worked in South Korea, and it sounded like the most dystopian nightmare. He got dragged off, having tests held for 24 hours in a bed, da da da. But the upshot of it was, aren't they great? And how rubbish London is. And I thought, oh my God, are we going to go that far?
I mean, it's worth pointing out that the UK didn't even have to make people quarantine for quite a long time. You could just come back into the country.
And even when they did impose quarantine, how many people were supposed to have been fined? I think it was about...
Yeah, I think a lot of people did actually. I think a lot of people did do the quarantine, though.
Oh, I don't doubt.
Yeah, so, I mean, I know people who came back and quarantined. You came back and quarantined.
I came back and quarantined, yeah.
Exactly. A lot of people definitely did do the 2 weeks. I mean, I suppose it just takes a few people not to do it. But yeah, it does. It's absolutely crazy that they're rolling this out now. But I suppose better to roll it out now than not, kind of thing.
This is why I think... By and large, we've not done badly, actually, as a country. I know that everybody starts hammering everybody. I've seen a lot of, this is on you if you've broken the rules. And I think, actually, you know, appealing to our better nature and better conscience is the better way to go about it.
No, I would 100% agree with you. And I would say that, actually, I think the vast majority of people, we keep getting all this, like, but people just need to obey the rules kind of message from people. It's like, actually, the vast majority of people are obeying the rules to a much greater extent than I would ever have expected them to do. And stopping people in their cars and asking them where they're going with a roadblock, or taping off benches... or asking a couple with a pushchair in the town centre what their justification for being out of the house is not a way to build national unity at a time when we need to rebuild the sense of national unity and purpose that saw us through the first lockdown, and everybody's actually just a bit pissed off with the whole thing. I think maybe appealing to people's better nature might be more successful than council COVID warriors out asking you exactly what you think you're doing leaving your house, and is that your spouse you're talking to?
No, I couldn't agree with you more, and I actually think this is important because I've been watching a lot of parallels in Spain. In Spain, they've got curfew from 11 o'clock at night. You can't go out. They've got vans going around with loudspeakers. You have to wear masks in the street, etc. Everybody there is petrified, absolutely petrified to leave their homes. Okay, that keeps people in now. The problem is when we start opening up and allowing people to go out, businesses to restart, you are going to have a population that is so frightened to do anything. How are we ever going to have that recovery that we need? There's a balance to be had and appealing to people's better nature, especially if we keep going in and out, in and out. I bought my coffee before I started the show, and I spoke to a small business owner who was luckily still open. But he said, I would rather we stay locked down for a month longer and we get this as sorted as much as we can than this in, out, in, out, in, out, which is just destroying companies. But anyway, we could go down this rabbit hole for much longer, and we don't have the time. I want to bring it back. I want to bring it back to where we started, which was UK shares and investing and the like. And I want to talk about Bitcoin. Now, I love Tom's article about Bitcoin because it begins with my dad's favorite phrase, which is, it's an ill wind that blows no good. Love that phrase. He does also say that there's no situation so bad it can't get worse, but that's by the by. Now, despite the devastation caused by the virus, we've just gone into it in detail, not everyone has had a bad year, particularly not those who've invested in Bitcoin. But is it too late to join the party? Lee, it keeps going on and on, despite what doomsayers are saying.
It's crazy, Georgie. I mean, by the time someone listens to this podcast, the price might have even gone higher, but of course it might have fallen. At $40,000 a coin, it has burst through.
$41,155.91 is the price currently displayed on CoinDesk as we speak. That's up 10% over the last 24 hours. As Lee points out, by the time you listen to this, what will have happened?
Who knows? I mean, Georgie, this is uncharted territory. I mean, obviously, when we've been talking about Bitcoin now for a long time, and in that 2017, late 2017, early 2018 surge, it was hard to get your head around what was kind of going on and what was behind the boom, and it was just a lot of people sort of getting involved, got up to $20,000 a coin, and then from there it kind of just stumbled, and it's been down in the doldrums, you know, a few thousand dollars a coin. It's just kind of been sort of ticking along. It's had a couple of bursts, maybe up to $5,000-$6,000 a coin, then back down, and not much has really happened with it. Now, in the last 3 months, we have just seen it absolutely skyrocket. I remember probably a month ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, we were talking about it. In fact, I think it was about a month ago, we were talking about it getting above $20,000 a coin for the first time. It's doubled since then, doubled. I mean, that is crazy. You asked me there, is it too late to get involved? I mean, how long is a piece of string, Georgie? I cannot tell you whether or not it's too late to get involved. We've got people on one hand who are saying that the price could go up absolutely astronomically. We've got a senior Citibank analyst predicting prices could exceed £230,000 a coin by the end of the year. And that's in pounds, not in dollars. I prefer talking about Bitcoin in dollars because it's a bit easier. But, you know, that's obviously a staggering amount that the coins could go up by. Can I tell you about a reader who got in touch with me yesterday? So back in 2017, in fact, in May 2017, I tweeted saying, if you bought a couple of quid of Bitcoin in May 2010, you'd now be a millionaire. So this was kind of before Bitcoin became mainstream, and I got tweeted, and I got one reply to that saying, I count myself lucky. I bought myself some at £150, but should have jumped in with both feet. Right, this is someone called Chris Hedrick, who I speak to sometimes on Twitter. I don't know him personally, but we sometimes have a bit of tweet back and forth. He dug out that tweet last night, and he said to me, bought Bitcoin at £150 a coin. When it reached £3,000 a coin, he paid off a chunk of his mortgage. When it got to £13,000 a coin, he bought a car. And when it got to £28,000 a coin, which was recently, he's wiped his mortgage. So from what he invested in at that 100, when it was at 150 quid a coin, that's what he's telling me. He also said that when it was at £480 a coin, he bought a Tesco meal deal in Bitcoin, and he now dreads to think how much that would have cost him if he just kept it in his Bitcoin wallet. I think he's doing all right. So, I mean, that's a kind of a real sort of extreme example. Someone got in early. And I guess that the thing is, and what happened around the boom last time is that people bought in quite high. And then the price obviously dropped like a stone, and people had the choice of either selling at a huge loss or hodling, keeping hold of the money and keeping hold of the Bitcoin and hoping that it had grown, which it has now gone way past that point. But the real thing to note here, George, is that if you are tempted, you need to do your research. I'm not going to go into intrinsic detail about what Bitcoin and cryptocurrency is, because it requires a whole podcast. But you need to go out there. You need to think about and realize what you're investing in. And also, you need to do it in a safe way, as in, you know, there's a lot of unscrupulous websites and things out there. So make sure you do your research in that regard. And even the ones that are most popular, so Coinbase is the most popular place for Britons to buy Bitcoin. It's based in San Francisco. I've got a Coinbase account. I got involved a few months back. and this is a point that Simon always makes, you know, it's meant to be this kind of coin which is off the radar, off of government interference. It's meant to kind of be, you know, off grid, so to speak. Yeah. But to get an account, you're going to need a passport or a driving license. You've got to put your bank account details in. There's all two-factor authentication. You know, it's not as simple as you might think. Coinbase, unsurprisingly, has seen an absolute flurry of activity of people trying to buy Bitcoin and the website crashing and the app crashing and that kind of thing. But also we've had quite a number of examples of people who have been locked out of their accounts for quite a few weeks. And that means that, you know, if they wanted to put in some money in Bitcoin a month ago, well, they've completely missed out now because, you know, the price has shot up. But in the same breath, if you were tempted to sell out there, but you couldn't because your account was locked, well, you've done all right out of it. So, you know, what I'm trying to say is there's a lot of, it's not as easy as what you might think. And you just need to go out there and do your research. And in terms of where the price goes from here, well, Georgia, honestly, I don't want to make.
Simon, I want to know what's happening with other cryptocurrencies.
Well, they're going bananas as well. So Ethereum, for example, has gone up loads. I mean, you've got Ethereum, you've got Ripple, you've got Bitcoin, you've got, you know, the smaller currencies. The last time around, there was the big boom. We saw this kind of explosion in people issuing coins. I think this time around, we're seeing that as well, but we're seeing more focus on the bigger ones. Whether, you know, Ether or Ripple really makes the kind of dent that Bitcoin has, there's talk that they're better. I don't know enough about cryptocurrency to really comment on that. The one thing I would say is that the reason why Bitcoin holds everyone's attention, because it's the one everybody knows. And if one of them is genuinely going to be a long-term store of value, and bear in mind, it's got a couple of thousand years to go before it starts to actually rival gold, which, you know, if you had been if you were picked up now and dropped into Roman Britain with a bit of gold, you'd be all right. If you were picked up now and dropped into Roman Britain with some Bitcoin in your Coinbase account, even if Coinbase was up and running, you'd be in trouble. So it has a way to go, but Bitcoin is the one that commands the attention and is the great store of value. They all swing around. Who knows? I've got some Bitcoin. I don't have any of the others. I ditched the Ethereum and Ripple that I had a couple of years back. I was like, nah, there's no point.
But these things are all in Bitcoin. They're not going anywhere.
No, well, not going anywhere, as in at the moment they're going up very quickly.
They can go up
very soon they might be going down very quickly as well. So not going anywhere is not necessarily true.
But up and down, yeah. As in disappearing altogether.
No, I don't think they're disappearing now. I don't think Bitcoin's going to disappear now.
So it's here to stay.
I might be wrong, but you know.
Indeed. Right, since let's move on from that. Since we last got together, we've actually left the EU. The sky, as far as I'm aware, didn't fall in. But then we have all been stuck indoors, so we might not have noticed. Firstly, Lee, have there been any food and medical shortages that was feared? I went into the post office, which has a Subway next to it, by the way. How snobby of me to say that I went into the post office, not the Subway. That was what I was telling you there. But it said, because of Brexit, we may have a few shortages, and so you may not get the sandwich that you want. But that's the only sign I've seen.
I saw someone else post something up the other day as well. There was a sign at a McDonald's saying there might be a shortage of lettuce and tomatoes, I think, which is a fundamental part of a Big Mac burger and a burger at McDonald's. But I don't know. I haven't left the house, Georgie. Has there been? I don't know. I've been just I've just been trapped inside these four walls. I haven't ventured anywhere. I don't know. As far as I'm aware, there hasn't been. But that's not to say that that's going to continue. I know before there was all this talk, especially around things like medicine and the worry over there being delays and getting things across. But it seems things have been relatively smooth. I mean, actually, we talked about the port chaos anyway in the last sort of 3 months of last year, when we were talking about not just Brexit but other factors that were kind of causing chaos at the ports in Britain, and that's for all sorts of goods coming in and out. And again, not to sound like a broken record, if you've listened to this podcast in recent times, all I keep hearing from business owners is about how much more expensive it's become to get a container via, you know, Europe and the rest of the world into Britain in the last few months. And that has been a factor of coronavirus, chaos at some of Britain's ports, and a little bit of Brexit as well. So, look, I mean, I always say to my wife, we're very lucky our generation, this country, we get any kind of food stuff that you want is in the supermarket. It's there. And it wasn't that long ago that you had to buy seasonal produce. You know, you had to buy whatever was available that was grown in Britain. And this time of year, that is very few amounts of fresh food. And we rely heavily on getting imports from not just Europe, but, you know, Northern Africa and places like that for stuff. But as far as I know, Georgie, forgive me if I'm wrong, and if people have seen stuff elsewhere, and please do report back at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. But I haven't seen, having read the news quite intrinsically in the last week, much sign of it.
But it's only been a little over a week. But we will get some changes that are going to affect, Lee, that pound in our pocket, as it were. Things like travel visas, e-hics, driving abroad, taking pets, blue passports, bank accounts, properties, savings, shopping, all those sorts of things. Give us a rundown. You've got a very useful article on your website. You don't have to say it all verbatim. So if you are interested, you can go and take a look at This Is Money. But Lee, give us some of the headlines.
Well, in terms of travel, Georgie, we'll touch on that because we were talking about it earlier in the podcast. Under the deal, holiday makers will still get free healthcare in EU countries. So EHIC is going to be phased out. People can use them until they expire. We're going to launch something called a global health insurance card, in which the details are currently quite vague, and we don't know the full details of that, but we'll kind of find out. The EU is looking to introduce a new visa system as well, which is similar to the ESTA in America, which you have to pay a few quid to get over for short trips. And then there's things like roaming charges, and that could go up. There could be some more added expenses when you're traveling abroad. Bank accounts is a worrying one, I would say, for expats, because what people do quite a lot of the times, they keep their UK bank account to get things like pension, their pension paid in, state pension and other bits and pieces like that. And they like that link to home. But it could be a bit of a bumpy ride for the 1.3 million expats who live in the EU, because Barclays, Lloyds, Halifax, Nationwide have been writing to customers in some countries saying that the bank accounts will be closed and credit cards cancelled because they don't have an EU banking license. And we've got these passporting rules that have expired. So we have got a guide. I won't go into full detail of that, but we do have a full guide on what to do if you are affected and if you're an expat listener and you're worried about your current account closing. It's kind of difficult to call what's going to happen in terms of property, especially if you own a property out in Europe. There's been quite a lot of worry from expats about kind of how that will affect them and what will happen. It's so difficult because obviously the Brexit deal document is a huge, chunky thing that would probably sink my house. It's that heavy. And actually, one of the highlights of over Christmas was watching Boris Johnson frantically wave it about, which actually did make me laugh quite a lot. It was like a Christmas highlight, which probably showed you how bleak Christmas was. In terms of savings, we have our financial services compensation scheme limit of £85,000. Now, the reason why that we mentioned that in terms of the EU is because it's actually set at €100,000. It's an EU-wide protection. We've been told that this limit won't change now Brexit's happened, and it's likely to stay to £85,000 for the next 4 years. That might get rejigged at that point. That's what FSCS have told us. What else do you want to know, Georgie? I'll let Simon pick up some of the things that he spotted.
My personal highlight from the Brexit deal is the fact that all those businesses and small businesses who've been told to get ready for Brexit and spent months going, okay, well, that's cool, but what are we actually getting ready for, can now dig into Boris's bumper tome and find out what they need to do. It's good news. Look, the problem is it doesn't cover services, okay, which is the bulk of the UK economy. And there is a big question over what's going to happen with financial services as well, which people might have noticed also makes this country quite a bit of money.
When you say it doesn't cover services or doesn't cover financial services, how do we get a deal that sort of didn't cover something?
Because a lot of the inter-EU trade that's easier to pin down is things like car parts. You know, the motor industry, where stuff is just constantly moving backwards and forwards across the borders. It's very obvious. It's like, look, this part that's going to go into that car is going from here to there and so on. Services is much harder. And services was actually, even for the EU, to be honest, it creating that level playing field has caused them a major headache over the years. For example, until very recently, really, we're only going back like maybe 10 years or so, the French made it very difficult for British ski instructors to work in France. Now, this might seem a little bit like kind of off the wall. Why is he using this example? But as a ski instructor, it's very easy to demonstrate that you can teach people to ski, right? And there are different qualifications that you can do. But the French, you have the École de Ski Française, which very much had the whole ski instructing thing sewn up. Now, it seems strange for us, but for some of the European economies, stuff like the ski industry is massive. There was this debate about when they were going to open the resorts and stuff. Austria, for example, it makes up something like, I think during winter, it makes up something like 5% of its economy. Now, that's similar to the German car making industry for Germany. So these things matter. So in France, within those mountain areas, the ski industry makes up a huge chunk of the economy. And those jobs as a ski instructor is a job for life, you know, that you can do. But British people wanted to go out. They wanted to work as ski instructors. They'd maybe trained over here. They could demonstrate that they could work as ski instructors. But they made it very difficult for them to do so. And they said, no, you have to do the French training and you have to do all this kind of stuff. And there was a big argument that went on about that for years and years and years. And it was sorted out pretty much. It still wasn't that level of playing field. That's all been taken away now. So now you've got lots of people who have worked out in the Alps for many years. Obviously, it's been very different last year and this year due to the pandemic. But, you know, these are people's careers and they've got real problems dealing with this kind of stuff. And that's just one little example. I mean, for example, another kind of type of services business is you might be a digital marketing company in the UK that has built up a digital marketing business over here and has built up a digital marketing business in France. Now, prior to the, you know, end of the year and Brexit, you could just operate from London, not a problem. And you people could just buy your services and so on and go backwards and forwards. Now it might be that in order to do your business, you're going to have to set up an office in Paris or Lyon or somewhere, some form of French office. There's a lot of we don't know about this kind of stuff. And obviously, as I said, services makes up a big part of the economy. Financial services is a huge thing because financial services, unlike, you know, digital marketing, you've got a big land grab going on from various countries over that. So Germany would like Frankfurt to dominate European financial services. France would like Paris to dominate European financial services. As it stands, for many years, London has dominated European financial services. But they, you know, the EU and the individual countries are looking at that and going, well, they left. You know, that was their choice. Why shouldn't we put up a few barriers in the way that don't favour Frankfurt or Paris, etc.? So, and these things are going to play out for years to come. Going back to what we were talking about at the start of this in terms of, you know, investing terms, the Brexit discount, etc., on investing in the UK, it's about, you know, once you factor in the different makeup of the UK stock market and the fact that we've just got lots of energy and resources and companies like that, and those things haven't done well, and we've got almost zero exposure to tech in this country. This is Tom Beckett, I spoke to on the investing show recently. He said the discount narrows to about 20% due to that kind of Brexit headache thing. Now, we could probably make up quite a bit of that ground, but will there still remain a bit of a Brexit discount? Because actually, for some of our most profitable companies, it might remain harder to do business in quite a sizable chunk of the world that is on their doorstep. Or doesn't it matter? We're going to see arguments go on about this for years to come.
All right. We'll leave that to one side. I do appreciate that is two massive topics that we've covered. So we're going to move on to another fairly large topic, actually. Moving home and house price boom. That's been kept us busy during the last year, especially in the latter half of last year. I'm sure there will be plenty of people still looking to strike while the iron is hot at the moment, sell their home in 2021, despite all the restrictions that are in place. The government has said that again during this lockdown, housing market to remain open. Activity in the first few months of the year is predicted then to be pretty intense, regardless of those restrictions. last minute buyers scrambling to complete before the end of the government's stamp duty holiday. Of course, that comes on the 31st of March so far. So if that is you, what is the best way to get the most value from your home and to make sure that it is appealing to buyers? Firstly, Lee, do you expect activity to be as hot as predicted? I mean, what are the early signs? And I appreciate it's very early signs.
It's hard to really tell how the property market is going to play out this year, Georgie, I would say. We've had a Halifax House Price Index come out today suggesting that prices are up 6% in the last year. But I think we're at the tail end of this sort of stamp duty boom that was fueled from the announcement in the summer, which is going to be drawing to an end soonish. So people that wanted to take advantage of that probably already have had to get the ball rolling in order to do so. And I think for that reason, it might mean a bit of a slower house price growth this year, I'd imagine. But I think a lot of indexes are really sort of not making stonewall predictions because they're hard to make at the best of times. But at the moment, they're incredibly difficult to sort of decide upon. Now, in terms of if you are someone that's thinking about moving home, and there are a few things that could help get the sale moving along in a time of a pandemic. And one of the first things to think about is how do you make a home appealing in the era of coronavirus? Now, what we mean by that is making use of any kind of outdoor space that you might have and making sure that that's highlighted in any kind of marketing material that goes out. And actually, even if you don't have one already, is potentially making one of your rooms or at least somewhere in your home look like it can be used as an office space. Because people are, you know, a lot of people who have office jobs are still working from home. And actually, although hopefully the vaccine rollout will mean a return to normality, hopefully in the spring, it might mean still that a lot of businesses have decided that people can work either part of the time or full time remotely. And that might mean that your home isn't working for you now and you need somewhere where you can get an office desk and an office chair. So it's worth thinking about that, especially if you've got like a box room and you've got a box room that just piles of boxes and actual just, you know, clutter instead of it being as a useful space, worth just clearing it out and putting in a cheap desk and a chair, and people can then see, well, yeah, that could be an office space. And some of this advice, it's just the same as it always has been. So sort of tackling those small DIY jobs, there's no excuse at the moment. You know, nothing massive, nothing that you're going to tackle that you can't do without a little bit of YouTube tutorial help. You know, the DIY stores are still open, a little bit of touch of paint work and all that kind of stuff. And clearing the clutter. Some more practical advice is to get planning permission. So basically, you know, if you could manage to get some plans drawn up for an extra room or where extra space could go, and that's half the battle for people, because obviously looking for extra space, and they might look at a home and go, oh, I wonder if we can get planning permission to do this. And if you've already somehow got it in place and you've been organized, that could be worth its weight in gold. Of course, picking a good estate agent is always key. We've got more choices than ever these days of online agents and high street agents, and high street agents that are, of course, probably largely working from home. But it's important to do research. And I always think, as a rule of thumb, in your area, you kind of know what signs you see more of, you know, what estate agent signs you see the most of, and checking out all of the fees and what they're going to do for you, making sure you do that right. I think one of the most important things is to get the price right, especially at the moment. I think people have kind of jumped on this bandwagon and thinking, cool, yeah, let's just bung the house up for an extra 15, 20 grand and see what happens. Let's go fishing type thing, which, you know, happens in a hot market. But the danger of doing that is that your house won't sell. That's not what you want. And I would say the last bit of advice in these times is to make viewings easy and COVID safe. You don't want people to come and view your home or come in and out of your home and feel a bit on edge. I mean, people will feel a bit on edge anyway because of the current climate. But, you know, social distancing and all that kind of thing, you know, you just want to make sure that you're not making it difficult for people. You just basically want to make it as easy for people as possible to do it.
Absolutely. Simon, is there enough time to benefit from the stamp duty holiday? Do you think we're likely to see that extended?
We could see it extended. There's a part of me that thinks that Rishi might quite like an excuse to extend it. We've obviously seen criticism that the average house price has gone up £15,000 since the stamp duty holiday was introduced. And the maximum saving from the stamp duty holiday is £15,000, which would, in theory, make it a false economy, even at that sort of basic comparison until you remember that you can't save £15,000 on the average house. You need to buy one costing £500,000 to save £15,000. And the average house price, according to Halifax today, is £253,000. So maybe, I think maybe there might be a good excuse for doing it. People might struggle to get sales through. Things will slow it down. Councils are in a bit of a disarray. Searches are causing problems. You're going to see, if once we start getting down to the wire, you'll see conveyancers working overtime late into the night, through the night, to get deals through. The banks, you know, the mortgage brokers are all going to be doing that. But will it be enough? This, you know, will they manage to do it? We'll see a big spike probably before the end of the holiday, and then you'll see a slump in sales afterwards. If we're in lockdown until late February, even, you know, the most optimistic case put forward to the nation, that's going to mean that we're only just emerging, and we're probably going to emerge from it slowly. We'll only be just emerging from it as the stamp duty holiday is ending. Then we see a sudden slump in house sales. Do they want to see that? Will they extend it? I don't know. Look, I've said it before. I just make it permanent, to be perfectly honest. Stamp duty is a bad tax, inhibits movement. Better that you've got people moving home. If you remove the temporary nature of it, it removes the sort of time limited element that pushes up prices. You could probably still get a deal through if you agreed it now and you acted really quickly and you weren't in a long chain, but you would have to really step on the gas. So we should see. But for a lot of people, bear in mind that stamp duty saving, if you're buying the average house, is not that much money. You know, you're buying a house that's costing £250,000 and you're saving £3,000 maximum, kind of thing. So it's money in your pocket that isn't in the government's, but it's not that amount of money for most people. So maybe it won't have as big an effect as we think. But the market does tend to get swayed by the stuff at the margins. And the stuff at the margins is the 750 grand, a million pound houses and stuff that's really driving stuff at the moment. But Halifax today, house price figures out. House prices up 6% in 2020, they reported. But monthly gains slowing. And we said, I don't know, mid to late November, I said, I reckon that we'd seen the end of the mini boom, and maybe the figures are starting to show that. I'll probably get proved wrong next month.
Yeah, but it's all right. You'll find, you know, 10 that'll prove you right and 10 that'll prove you wrong, because there's so many, which is why I love house price figures so much. Lee?
I was just going to add to that. I know I said in that last bit about keeping your home as COVID friendly as possible. Of course, to add to that is to make sure that when you are marketing your home, it's things like now having like a virtual tour of your house or of your home. And the reason why I'm saying this is because we've actually been toying up potentially moving. We were doing that tentative house hunt, which people now do from their sofa, you know, when you're looking through all the different homes and everything. And there was this one home, it kind of looked a bit bog standard. I wasn't that enamored by it. And it had a virtual tour, as in it had like a video production, a bit of money had been, looked like it had been thrown in, 90 second clip. And it became on the, actually, that's quite a nice list. So it can show you the power of having the photography and videography done correctly. And that is going to be more important than ever, because people are already hunting for homes. Their first port of call tends to be a property portal anyway. I think it's even more important now. We're in coronavirus times, when people are kind of sometimes just filling in boredom gaps by having a look at homes for sale. And that kind of, you know, content is key.
And if you do that, right, and the estate agent does a video tour or asks you to do one, some of them look really whizzy. Some of them is clearly someone walking around with a phone, but you could do a reasonable job walking around with a phone. But if you do get one done and you look at it and you think, actually, I don't think that makes my house look very good, don't use it. Okay, better to not have one than to have one that makes your house look not as good as it is. It's the same with photographs. Always pay attention to presentation. Estate agents, I do not know how some of the high street estate agents and some of the online estate agents get away with some of the pictures that they post of people's houses. If you are not happy with the pictures of your house, get the estate agent background to take some new pictures. And that includes whether you think they don't make your house look very big, they don't make your house look very nice, or you look at them and go, those look great, but my house is nowhere near that big, okay? Don't let them like wide angle your whole house to the point where a buyer comes around and goes, nah, I was kind of liked it on the internet, but I don't like it in person. So yeah, pay real attention to the presentation of that stuff.
Indeed. All right, one quick one. One thing that people look for a lot, broadband, Wi-Fi speeds, etc. Never more important as now when we're working from home and stuck at home and looking for houses to buy on the internet. But very quickly, if you would, Lee, run us through. You've spoken to an expert about some of the most common internet problems and how we can fix them. And it's more than just turn your computer off, turn it back on again and pray.
Well, that's what I was going to say, if you try turning it off and on again, because actually that is the thing that solves the most Wi-Fi problems, definitely in this house. I have to reset the router once a week in order for everything to work. And we're obviously using Wi-Fi more than ever before, and in this house and everywhere else, I'd imagine, to stream TV, to listen to music, to do work sometimes, and all the other things that we now rely on the internet for. And of course, some people will be absolutely banging their head against their desk or table or wherever it is that they're working at the moment, going, why is my Wi-Fi so slow and it's so annoying when it drops out? And I definitely have that sometimes, and it's annoying. So one of the things I've done, and this is something that I've done probably about 6 months ago, is actually move my router. So it's a little bit, it was getting blocked a little bit. So people actually sometimes put their router too close to like a wall, or put an object next to it, or, you know, something that actually blocks the signal a little bit, and that can actually have an effect. So where you place the router is quite important. You don't want to put it near a large object, which it sounds like common sense, but a lot of people might not realize that. Of course, as well, depending on whereabouts in your house, if you are working from home, whereabouts the router is. So in the room that I'm recording this podcast, I'm actually at the other side of the house to where the router is, and upstairs. So it's quite a long way for it to travel. And if you're finding that it's just not working quick enough, you might want to just get closer to the router. Again, sounds so simple. Some people may just not have thought about this. Another one as well is people, I think, are sometimes worried about changing broadband provider because they think it's going to be a complete faff, which, to be honest, it quite often is. And I think there should be almost like the current account switching guarantee. There should be some sort of guarantee that if you switch broadband provider, you're going to have absolutely no interruption in your service, because that's what people worry about. And for that reason, they stick with the same internet provider. Prices go up a little bit each year. They may not be haggling for better speeds. They might be able to get better speeds elsewhere for far less money. At the moment, I think people are so frightened to take that jump and do it, but you shouldn't do. And if you are going to move provider, you should get them to guarantee that from this day, it's going to work. And if it doesn't, then you want to know what they're going to do to do it. Again, there's some quick fixes you can do. You can disconnect unnecessary devices. That's something we do in this household quite a lot. It's so surprising how many devices now you set up on Wi-Fi. You know, your phone, your laptop, your TV, your smart speakers, your smart thermostat, you know, all sorts of things are relying on Wi-Fi more than ever before. And if you've got all of these things on at the same time and your speed isn't very good, well, it could be that. And one of the best things to do is to run a speed test, actually. So I went to see my mum before this latest lockdown, when it was safe. I can't even remember. I've lost track of months and dates. And she was complaining about how slow her internet was, and we did a speed test. She didn't know how to do a speed test. I showed her how to do it, and she was getting some criminal rate of Wi-Fi, the kind of rate of Wi-Fi that if you're working from home, it definitely wouldn't work properly. She can't stream TV and all this kind of stuff. So I told her to pick up the phone, speak to her internet provider, mm-hmm. tell them how slow the internet was, said why hadn't it been suggested to her that she gets better Wi-Fi speeds and get on a different package. And she phoned up. Lo and behold, she's now paying less money, and she's got, I don't know, something like 30 times the speed that she had before. So, you know, it can be worthwhile doing that as well. And these all, I know for some people that are listening to this are going, God, Lee, this is so basic. Like, but these are the basic things that you can do. There's not much else. There's no sort of like trick or, you know, some sort of magic way of getting faster broadband without doing those things, in my opinion.
One of the things that we bought that helped us is one of these power line boosters that you get, where you plug in a plug into the plug socket, yeah, by the router, and then you connect it to the router, and it then sends the internet through your power lines, and then you have a Wi-Fi thing at the other end that then beams out the Wi-Fi. Anybody who knows anything about technology is going to be shaking their heads at my description of this. The little magic people take the internet and they run round your power lines into the other room and then they climb into the plug at the other end and they beam it back out to you. And it does work a treat, actually. Ours is won by some company that makes them called TP-Link, but there's lots of other ones. But it does work. So that's one option.
Excellent. Any more options, do let us know. Thank you very much for listening. That's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments about this, any questions for the team, anything you'd like them to investigate on your behalf, Simon?
You could email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, or you can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all the podcast articles and join in the debate in reader comments, and wish everyone a happy new year.
Indeed. Happy new year, everyone. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.